Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. This Sunday, June 19th, is officially Father's Day because it is the third Sunday of the month this year. But every year since 1865, it has been Juneteenth, Black Emancipation Day. More about that later. I start today's program with a war story, which is a personal experience that might deserve a disclaimer. So I humbly claim it as my own version and opinion, which might or might not be disputed among the very few who also survived and remain alive half a century afterward. I call it Howard's Hill. A rough hand shook me awake before dawn one morning of the war. Charlie jumped a patrol, an urgent voice rasped in my ear. I kicked off a skimpy blanket, pulled on a pair of boots, found my rifle and camera, hung a pistol and cartridge belt from my shoulder, and stepped outside a tent I shared with other suddenly awakened young men. Shadowy figures moved briskly about me, clustering into groups like well-worn grooves. "Good morning, Vietnam," one muttered. The company commander was waiting for us on a dry rice field that was used for helicopter landings. I was unable to make out individual features in the dusk, but I knew enough of them to pick out by shape a few, slouch, or by voice. "A recon patrol's been hit," the skipper said in his usual quiet-spoken manner. He was a moderate-sized man who habitually wore a bush hat. Despite orders, all of us wear helmets. I could not see his face, but I sensed his grim humor, a wry smile underneath a thick mustache, his quick, piercing eyes, seeing everything, even in darkness. And of course, he was the first to hear the approaching helicopters, even when mosquitoes seemed the only sounds, aside from the shuffling and rattling of men and weapons. Such was how today began, 50 years ago, which was also a Thursday, June 16th, 1966. USMC Staff Sergeant Jimmy Howard and his reconnaissance patrol were attacked by a large North Vietnamese Army force on Hill 488, Nui Vu, north of Chu Lai, South Vietnam. They had been on the hill a couple of days reconnoitering nearby valleys and ridges for activity hostile to Americans, radioing for artillery and airstrikes whenever they saw anybody moving within their sight. Usually the objects of such attention triangulated the incoming shells and bombs and looked for the highest hill, which would be the most likely place to find the Marines responsible for summoning the destruction, and waited for nightfall to attack. The recon Marines were hit from all sides of the hill on the night of June 15th by at least a battalion of North Vietnamese soldiers. The attack lasted all Wednesday night and early Thursday morning, June 16th. Jets and helicopters bombed, rocketed, and machine gunned the fields and villages around the hill at daybreak. Two helicopter gunships were shot down. The pilot of one and crew chief of the other were killed. I was with the infantry platoon that was sent to get Howard and his team off the hill, acting as a Sparrowhawk rescue platoon, 2nd Platoon, Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment. Immediately after helicopters landed us on the hill, three of our group were killed, including the platoon leader, an Annapolis graduate in his first combat action, 2nd Lieutenant Ron Myers, known as Stump for his short, husky body. He and the two others who died with him were the first up the hill to relieve the dead and wounded recon team. I was in the second helicopter and reached the crest with a few other Marines moments after Stump was killed, attacking an NVA machine gun that also killed the other two men, a rifleman, Terry Reddick, and a medical corpsman, John Markelli, who tried to reach Stump after he got hit. I had spent much of the previous night talking with Stump, getting to know him, a short-lived experience. He, Reddick, and Markelli were the last Marines to die on Hill 488, as it was named by its height in meters. Nui Vu was its Vietnamese name. But from that day on, it was called Howard's Hill by Americans, after the recon leader who was awarded a Congressional Medal of Honor for his night-long defense of the hill. Two others of Howard's team got Navy crosses. The rest, dead and wounded, received Silver Stars, and of course, Purple Hearts for all of them, for wounds, fatal or otherwise. My sole distinction that morning was that I was the only reporter in the world on that hill, merely an enlisted Marine Corps combat correspondent, but a journalist, no matter who I worked for. And it was my initial story that alerted the world press to what had occurred. Otherwise, I kept my head down just below the hill crest. The bodies of the recon patrol lay all over the hill, some of them dead, the rest wounded. Around them lay about 50 dead Vietnamese in khaki uniforms. The recon medical corpsman, a red-haired, freckled man named Billy Holmes, released his fear, anger, and relief that we had arrived by jamming a bayoneted rifle into the body of a dead Vietnamese. Holmes had been wounded, yet spent the night caring for the other wounded and dying Marines. Jimmy Howard was also alive, and until his large body was carried to helicopters trying to land on the steep slope on the side of the hill away from the two machine guns that were left to cover the North Vietnamese withdrawal, he called out firing directions to the Marines coming up onto the hill. Charlie Company's Captain Marshal Buckingham Darling, in my opinion, the best officer I knew in the USMC, simply called Buck by officers and enlisted, rushed to get Stump's body with Lance Corporal Jimmy Brown, called Bleep Bird, because in garrison he was a screw-up, but in combat he was solid. They went down the hill in a series of rushes, covered by our rifles and by two large Crusader jets flying just above our heads in what has been termed the closest air support in history, with, perhaps, the exception of a U.S. Army captain who called napalm onto his overrun position near Saigon later that year. We could almost touch the big jets as they roared over us on the hill in swift blurs of steel and sound. Fragments of their 20-millimeter cannon flew back at us and ricocheted off the rocks we crouched among. Buck and Brown timed their rushes back up the crest with Stump's body. When the jets swooped so closely over our heads, I worried their exhaust afterburners might set some of us on fire. Eventually, one of the Vietnamese machine gunners left by the retreating NVA attackers was killed by the airstrikes. The second was finally shot when a squad from the platoon charged him in the old-fashioned way from another side of the hill. The squad leader was creased in the side of his head, his second such wound in a week. Every Thursday, Corporal Samuel J. Roth gets shot in the head, I wrote later in a story that appeared in Stars and Stripes. The dead Vietnamese who shot him had almost hurled a grenade when he died, and it was still in his hand when the Marines reached him. Amidst all this clamor, we evacuated the dead and wounded from Howard's recon team and the three dead from the Sparrowhawk platoon I was with, clumsily handing them up into helicopters that were only able to flimsily perch on two wheels on the steep slope, roaring their rotors for balance to do even that. We found drag marks and blood trails of dead and wounded Vietnamese soldiers, or hardcore Viet Cong, we called NVA troops in uniform at the time, on all sides of the hill, indicating they were hauled off during the night and early morning, probably during their attacks. Then we walked off Howard's Hill and were loaded onto helicopters in a rice field for the flight back to the USMC base at Chulai by the Sea. I am pretty sure the bodies of the dead Vietnamese we left on the hill were quickly removed, as was the case with most VC, Viet Cong, or NVA killed in the war, quickly removed to deny the United States its only scoreboard of the war, body count. I remember that at first, the Marines wanted to cover up the affair on Howard's Hill because high-level brass did not want the American people to know about it, which is a reflex act at all levels of the military as well as government. I was able to get the story released after convincing my military superiors that the NVA and Viet Cong, as well as Ho Chi Minh in Hanoi, obviously knew about it and would most likely use it for their own propaganda purposes. Once publicly known, Howard's Hill was mythologized as a heroic action, the Alamo with survivors, one Marine said, rather than a blunder or a breach of military intelligence, an oxymoron. It became a still frame in itself, an isolated skirmish, but it had actually been a preliminary reconnaissance for a search-and-destroy assault which took place later that summer called Operation Colorado. The Marine combat operations were named after states that. Not on Hill 488, June 16, 1966, with Howard's recon team, was their company commander, a captain named Timothy Garrity. In 1983, as a full-bird colonel, he was the senior officer of troops landed ashore when 250 Marines were blown apart in a hotel by a suicide bomber. He was made scapegoat for the tragedy by the brass in charge, to whom he had vainly protested billeting Marines in the hotel, so closely packed together that a single explosion killed more than half and wounded most of the rest. Also not on Howard's Hill was USMC Captain Francis J. West, known as Bing, who later was an Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and has written many books on military policy. He was in Vietnam studying Marine combat operations in the summer of 1966 and wrote a small book, which included a chapter about Howard's Hill. A man who was on Howard's Hill wrote a whole book about it. Ray Hildreth was a Lance Corporal member of Howard's recon team and received a Silver Star for destroying a couple of machine guns during the night until he was wounded by automatic fire. 37 years later, in 2003, he wrote his book, Hill 488, the only book I know of written by a survivor, few of whom are still alive, half a century and the start of a new millennium later, which I suppose includes me. The names of the dead Marines are all alphabetically clustered by the date of their deaths on the Vietnam Wall. The North Vietnamese soldiers who were killed, poor unknowns, as the masses of dead soldiers of World War I were called, are probably not recorded anywhere except as body count and in memories of their families. The same anonymity accorded the collateral deaths of peasant farmers and their children when bombs, napalm, rockets, and machine gun fire ravaged the fields and villages that surrounded the besieged Marines on Howard's Hill. The U.S. Army took over the Chulai base and airstrip the following year after the Marines moved further up north toward the demilitarized zone that separated North from South Vietnam. It was from Chulai that Army 2nd Lieutenant William Calley and his infantry platoon of the AmeriCal Division boogied forth to massacre the unarmed civilians of My Lai Village on March 16, 1968. Jimmy Howard and Buck Darling died 10 years apart, 1993 and 2003, respectively, long finished with wars, although wars and massacres continue, such as in Orlando, Florida, this past weekend. And that was Howard's Hill. And now, Juneteenth is for Everyone, by Kenneth C. Davis. Some 2 months after General Robert E. Lee surrendered on April 9, 1865, effectively ending the Civil War, Major General Gordon Granger steamed into the port of Galveston, Texas, with 1,800 Union soldiers, including a contingent of United States colored troops. Granger was there to establish martial law over the westernmost state in the defeated Confederacy. On June 19th, 2 days after his arrival, and 151 years ago this Sunday, Granger stood on the balcony of a building in downtown Galveston and read General Order Number 3 to the assembled crowd below. The people of Texas are informed that, in accordance with a proclamation from the Executive of the United States, all slaves are free, he said. This was the first time many in the crowd had learned of the Emancipation Proclamation, which President Abraham Lincoln had issued 2.5 years before. White slaveholders had suppressed the news of the decree freeing slaves in Confederate territory, not under Union control. We all walked down the road singing and shouting to beat the band, a Texas freedwoman recounted. Black men pitched their hats high in the muggy June air, according to another report. Men and women screamed, "We's free, we's free." Others left town in what became known as the scatter. The jubilation following Granger's announcement in Galveston moved across Texas quickly, reaching the state's 250,000 enslaved people. A year later, a spontaneous holiday called Juneteenth, formed from the words June and 19th, began to be celebrated by the newly freed people of Galveston and other parts of Texas. In 1867, Austin, the Texas state capital, saw its first Juneteenth celebration under the direction of the Freedmen's Bureau, the federal agency created to provide relief to people displaced by the Civil War. Embraced as an exuberant day of jubilee, Juneteenth combined a history lesson and a political rally with the gospel hymns and sermons of a church service. Barbecue was soon added to the mix, this being Texas, with strawberry-flavored red soda water to wash it down. In time, rodeos, baseball games, and family reunions all became part of Juneteenth traditions. As former slaveholders attempted to maintain their control, this display of freedom was often met with violence. Juneteenth revelers sought the relative safe haven of black churches, a poignant irony given the tragedy last June 17th in Charleston, South Carolina, when 9 parishioners of historic Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church were murdered, including the senior pastor, Clementa C. Pinckney, by a young white man, Dylan Roof, who wanted to start a race war. Some of these Texas churches began raising money to buy land on which to mark Juneteenth. In Houston, 2 black congregations collected pennies and nickels until a 10-acre parcel was purchased for $800 in 1872 and named Emancipation Park, which is still used today. The Festival of Freedom spread across the former Confederacy in the late 19th century. And as African Americans moved north, they carried this celebration of liberation with them. As Isabel Wilkerson wrote in The Warmth of Other Suns, her prize-winning account of the Great Migration, the people from Texas took Juneteenth Day to Los Angeles, Oakland, Seattle, and other places they went. Even now, with barbecues and red soda pop, they celebrate June 19, 1865. Granger's order was momentous, but it was no magic bullet. Even with the ratification of the 13th Amendment in December 1865, the emancipated people of Texas and the rest of America confronted violent resistance as they attempted to claim the promise of their liberation. Any small gains came in the face of whips, guns, and lynching, followed by the well-documented decades of Jim Crow laws and Klan terror. Officially neglected, over time, Juneteenth lost much of its resonance in the black community. But it has enjoyed a renaissance in recent years, spurred by a revival of pride in the Afro-American traditions long denied or suppressed. Juneteenth has gained official recognition, although not necessarily full legal holiday status, in a number of states, starting appropriately with Texas, which made Juneteenth a paid holiday for state employees in 1980. Still, 151 years after its birth, Juneteenth remains largely unacknowledged on America's national calendar. Many Americans are unaware of its existence or its roots. Sadly, that ignorance of Juneteenth reflects a deeper issue, the continued existence of 2 histories, black and white, separate and unequal. Frederick Douglass voiced that fundamental divide in a memorable speech on July 4, 1852, to a majority white audience. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, but not by me, he said. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. Juneteenth is the flip side of the Independence Day coin. A century and a half after General Granger told the enslaved people of Texas they were free, Juneteenth is viewed by many of those who are aware of it as an African-American holiday. That perception unfairly diminishes the fundamental significance of Juneteenth. The day should be recognized for what it is, a shared point of pride in the symbolic end of centuries of racial slavery, a crime against humanity and the great stain on America's soul. As meaningful as Independence Day itself, Juneteenth completes the circle, reaffirming life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as the rights of all, not a select few. And that was Juneteenth is for Everyone by Kenneth C. Davis, who is an historian and author of Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned, which was written in 1990, Don't Know Much About the Civil War, 1996, and most recently, in 2015, The Hidden History of America at War, Untold Tales from Yorktown to Fallujah. He wrote this article for the New York Times. Oregon is among 41 states that recognize Juneteenth as a state holiday, but Congress has consistently refused to pass legislation to authorize Juneteenth to be a national observance. And now I'd like to read a little bit of satire by Robert Brake, who lives up on the peninsula. Donald Trump meets Archie Bunker. Great news. I am privy to a private conversation between Donald Trump and Archie Bunker. Yes, that Archie, beloved blue-collar conservative champion of yesteryear. Seems that Trump recently fired his employee terminator, Laura Daboom, as she wanted to get even. And she wanted to get even. So she secretly recorded the following conversation between Trump and Bunker at the Beacon Tavern at Trump International Hotel and Tower in Chicago. Huddled in an adjoining booth, Laura overheard the following remarks. Trump, I suppose you're wondering why I asked you to join me for lunch today, Archie. Bunker, yeah, I'm wondering. Say, I like your red cap. Let's make America great again. Trump, thanks, Arch. I need some of your great advice from yesteryear, okay? I love the poorly educated. Bunker, thank you, Mr. T. Fire away. Trump, well, I've gotten lots of flack for occasional remarks about women, some accusing me of calling women pigs, dogs, and bimbos. But I say I will be good to women. I will be phenomenal to the women. Bunker, no problem, Donald. Remember what I said about Dingbat and Gloria and their ilk? Women are made from a man's rib and are inferior, so we get a cheaper cut. Besides, women's livers have a lot of fancy ideas that just don't belong, like putting lace on a bowling ball, and a woman should cleave unto her husband like my dingbat does. Right here is where Edith's cleavage belongs. Trump, the liberal pinkos are calling me irreligious. But I tell them nobody reads the Bible more than me, especially 2 Corinthians. The Bible's even better than my Art of the Deal, and that's no small feat. Bunker, tell them we need to respect God and teach our kids that the Bible ain't no booby trap. They need to be scared of God, period. Trump, I was the first candidate to really focus on the immigration problem, Archie. I said we needed to build a huge wall to keep out Mexican drug dealers, terrorists, rapists, and other thugs, though some Mexicans are great. I tell them I'll be the worst thing that's ever happened to ISIS by keeping Muslims from invading our shores. What do you think about immigration, Archie? Bunker, I said way back, no bum that can't speak perfect English ought to stay out of this country, ought to be de-exported the hell out of here. And I don't want no Hispanics living next door. One colored family is a novelty. 2's a ghetto. We gotta protect our property. Besides, any blacks moving into my neighborhood will never have much to do for recreation. No crap games, pool halls, chicken shacks, or rib joints within miles. Trump, they're still talking a lot about gun control, wanting to take away our Second Amendment rights. Some smart folks think we Americans should protect our school children by arming teachers and allowing freedom-loving Americans to protect themselves by wearing guns to churches, taverns, gun shows, and other places where their lives might be endangered. Bunker, right. Way back in 72, I said we could protect Americans from skyjacking terrorists by arming all passengers. Just pass out pistols at the beginning of the trip and pick them up at the end. All I know is I'm an American and I got a right to pack a rod. Guns is red, white, and blue. Case closed. Trump. Great advice, Archie. Say, what do you think about welfare? You know, how liberal pinkos want to take us fabulously rich guys' hard-earned money and give it away to poor, shiftless street bums. Bunker. It's all a conspiracy, Donald. The Democrats' way of ruining the country is to go tell us how we ought to make sacrifices, giving away my money to spicks and spades. They're all going to have us over the hill to the poorhouse. If these progressive pinkos get their way, we're all going to hear one big flush. The country's going straight into the dumpster. Trump. How do you feel about other races, Archie? You know, the inferior ones. Bunker. I'm not a racist. I'll be the first to say it. It's not their fault they're colored. Thanks, Mr. Bunker. And I can promise you that, when I'm elected, there will be hell to pay. T-O-U-P-E-E. Get it? Ha ha ha. Note. Presumably, Donald Trump will incorporate some of Archie Bunker's advice into his fall campaign. One of the Donald's official spokespersons, Howie Evasive, recently advised me that the master of self-promotion is planning to have his impulsivity and his hands enlarged and his modesty diminished. And that was Donald Trump Meets Archie Bunker by Robert Brake, who is a freelance writer and retired college teacher. As he says, not one of the poorly educated Trump seems to so admire, and he lives in Ocean Park, Washington, on the peninsula. And I'd like to finish more or less with the fact that the legendary Ship Inn in Astoria has been sold to an out-of-town investor who acts like a John Jacob Astor wannabe, with plans for multiple development projects in the city, including a large motel under the 50-year-old Astoria Megler Bridge. Owned and operated by Jill and the late Fenton Stokeld, the English-style fish and chips pub and restaurant has been a favorite with locals and tourists for more than four decades. The Ship Inn has been a family affair between owners, staff, and customers. The same building was once a now nearly mythical riverfront saloon named the Mermaid Tavern, which was popular with maritime and workaday folk during the final years of Astoria's reign as a fishing town, and was famous for a large wood carving of a mermaid by Roger McKay. Debbie Reed, a longtime employee at the Ship Inn with her sister Becky, wrote a poem in 1999 in response to an article about Astoria in the Oregonian. It was first printed in the Daily Astorian and afterward in the North Coast Times Eagle, which happily published many of her poems. From the Ship Inn by Debbie Bernsey Reed. People come here for many reasons. Peace and quiet, R&R, fish and chips. Most come just to visit. Some come to stay. Good schools, quiet streets, a nice little mixture of coffee houses, art, blue-collar jobs, and scenery. I think sometimes about these comings and goings as I look out the window over the customer's shoulder and patiently explain the difference between halibut and cod again. I think of how things move here, how the sprinkle of snow closes 8th Street and decorates the peaked roofs of the Victorian-style homes with frost, how the deep orange sun sinks below the Megler Bridge in July, how the flat, solid autumn blue of the ocean turns into the wild, churning river, how the rain gets cold, then warmer, then colder still, as the men move their boats into position for crab or sturgeon or nothing at all, how I left here once thinking like that city reporter that roads here lead to nowhere, and how I returned later to stay, glad to be home, glad to see the familiar faces in the pub, glad to see their gladness at seeing me. Now at work, I serve the tourists and watch Brian and Stacy thrust their big knives into the soft, pale belly of the huge halibut, stripping away the skin, leaving the thick, pink fish meat people will drive for miles to eat. And I want to tell that city reporter Don't take pity on us. It is we who pity you. We know if you only look at the underside of a fish, you only see the white, vulnerable, sad side that waits for its death. If you stop there, you will miss the silvery scales, the useful, mighty fins, the flashing eye. And that was by Debbie Bairnsey Reed from The Ship Inn, which she wrote in 1999. And this is Michael McCusker. Happy Juneteenth and Father's Day.